Hello, Sentence Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader, with stories from the American West. This is Arizona history. In my readings, we'll focus mainly on the events and characters that shaped our Arizona history and culture. Today, I will tell you about
Eskimensin's revenge. By killing Charles McKinney, his friend, Chief Eskimensin committed a stunning betrayal. Later, he explained, "I did it to teach my people that there must be no friendship between them and the white man. Anyone can kill an enemy, but it takes a strong man to kill a friend." After the killing of Chief Mangus Coloradus in 1863, the war continued, marked by periods of relative calm, followed by incidents of plunder and killing, and then the inevitable revenge. One of the most fascinating of such episodes occurred in southeastern Arizona in a modest San Pedro River farmhouse in the first week in June 1871. After dinner, over coffee, rolled cigarettes, and pleasant talk, an Aravapia Apache chief suddenly drew his pistol and fired at eyeball range, killing a 35-year-old Irishman named Charles McKinney. In the large picture, the murder of an unknown farmer, sublimely cold though it was, hardly seems worthy of mention, but the event spoke volumes about the desperate times in which it occurred. The killing was an outgrowth of a massacre a month earlier of at least 100 Aravapi Apaches by a vigilante mob. The leader of the slaughtered band was Eskimensin, who later said he pulled the trigger on McKinney to teach his people a hard lesson about never trusting white men. But McKinney had nothing to do with the so-called Camp Grant massacre. In fact, numerous sources report that the simple farmer had been a friend to the chiefs to the instant of his death. By killing him, Eskimensin committed one of the most stunning betrayals of this or any other war. The lead-up to the McKinney murder began in February 1871, when five Apache women approached Camp Grant, 100 or so miles northeast of Tucson. They wanted help searching for the son of one of them, who had been taken prisoner in the Salt River area of central Arizona. Their arrival at the military post came at a time of much hostility. Raids by Cochise's band, among others, had inflamed Arizona citizens against all Indians, and further cries for the military to stop them. Whether the tribes were herded onto reservations or exterminated mattered little to the increasing number of settlers. Amid this climate, Camp Grant's commander, Lieutenant Royal Whitman, treated the five visitors with unexpected kindness. Within days, more Apaches came to the camp to trade for badly needed clothing. Soon, at Whitman's encouragement, some 25 Apaches, including three chiefs, came to the post to talk. They were hungry, sick, and worn out from harassment by soldiers. One of them, Eskimensin, told Whitman that he wished his small band could live in peace in their homeland along the Aravaipa Creek, not far from Camp Grant. The 37-year-old Maine-born lieutenant, knowing a reservation would soon be established in the White Mountains, tried to convince Eskimensin to move his people there, but the chief refused. "That is not our country, neither are they our people," Eskimensin said. "Our fathers and their fathers before them have lived in these mountains and have raised corn in this valley. We are taught to make mezcal our principal article of food, and in summer and winter here we have a never-failing supply. At the White Mountains there is none, and without it we get sick." The chief was told by Whitman he would wire Arizona's military commander, General George Stoneman, asking for permission to grant Eskimensin's request. Meanwhile, if the chief brought his people to the post, Whitman would care for them as long as they remained peaceful. Whitman had to wait 6 weeks to hear from Stoneman, and the response to this important matter was mind-boggling. A clerk wrote to inform the lieutenant that he could not forward the memo to the general because it failed to include a note summarizing its content per Army instructions. A timely response probably wouldn't have headed off the disaster to come. However, with Apache raids continuing south of the Gila River, The delay certainly didn't help. Meanwhile, Apaches continued streaming into Camp Grant, and by April, they numbered more than 400. Impatient and fearful, the residents of Tucson reached the limit of their endurance after a raid on April 10th on the San Javier Mission outside town, and another one a few days later near the San Pedro River, in which four settlers were killed. Angry citizens led by William Sanders Aury, a participant in the Bascom Affair, and Jesus Maria Elias, a leader of the town's Mexican descent population, formed a posse consisting of 6 Anglos, 92 Papagos, and 42 Mexicans to punish those responsible. The mob set out after the killers and believed that found the Gratos Trail along the San Pedro River northeast of Tucson. By then, Eskimensin's band had moved with Whitman's permission 5 miles from the post to an area along the Aravaipas Creek where water was plentiful. Aravaipa Creek lies in the valley just east of the San Pedro. Early on in the morning of April 30th, the vigilantes descended on Eskimensin's rancheria, the term commonly used in the 19th century to refer to Indian camps, in what can only be described as mass murder. At least 100 Aravaipas died, many with their brains beaten out and their limbs hacked off. Some women, caught amid the fury, were raped and clubbed to death. Aury described the action as if it was a great military victory, even though all but 8 of the dead were women and children. 75 Apache youngsters were taken by the Papagos and sold into slavery in Mexico. President Ulysses S. Grant called the massacre purely murder, and historian Frank Lockwood described it as the blackest page in the Anglo-Saxon records of Arizona. Horrified by the brutality, Whitman tried to assure the Indians that soldiers were not responsible. He offered interpreters $100 apiece to go to the mountains and communicate with them, and convinced them that no officer or soldier of the United States government had been concerned in the vile transaction. When none accepted his offer, Whitman went to the scene and personally led a burial detail, aware that others of the band likely were watching them from the surrounding hills. I thought the act of caring for their dead would be an evidence to them of our sympathy, at least, he wrote, and the conjecture proved correct, for while at work, many of them came to the spot and indulged in their expressions of grief, too wild and terrible to be described. Eskimensin, who probably was present that terrible morning, although that is uncertain, lost 2 wives and 5 children in the attack. By one estimate, 50 of his relatives were killed. A few days after the massacre, Eskimensin returned to Camp Grant, carrying his only surviving daughter, Cheetah, was sometimes referred to as Dina, in his arms. He pleaded with Whitman for help in securing the return of the stolen children. The lieutenant vowed to do what he could, and convinced the chief not to go to war. Hopes for peace ended in a tragic blunder about June 2nd. A scouting party from Camp Apache rode into Aravaipa's canyon and stumbled upon some Apaches, including Eskimensin. In surprise and fear, the cavalry opened fire. No one was killed, but the chief finally had had enough. "I have tried, and my people have tried," he told Whitman, "but the peace you have promised to the Aravaipa has been broken not one, but 2 times. Both times it was the Americans who broke the peace. The first one who breaks the peace is the one to blame." Eskimensin angrily departed for the mountains, killing McKinney on the way, his first act of retaliation. On June 13th, he attacked a wagon train en route from Tucson's Camp Lowell to Camp Bowie, killing 1 soldier, although the chief lost 13 of his warriors and was himself wounded. In September, Whitman sent word to Eskimensin, still hiding in the mountains, that Vincent Coiler, a peace emissary sent by President Grant, was coming to the territory to establish a reservation for Apaches. After meeting with White Mountain bands of Camp Apache earlier that month, Coiler went to Camp Grant and met with Eskimensin on September 15th and again on September 17th. Collier told the chief he was creating a reservation for the band near Aravaipas Canyon and appointing Whitman as a reservation agent. However, peace again eluded Eskimensen. On October 22nd, he was indicted by a federal grand jury for McKinney's murder. This caused the Arizona Citizen, which had been raging against Whitman and his peace plans, to intensify its editorial attacks. On October 28th, anti-Apache editor John Wesson sounded the trumpets against Eskimensen. Let the nation at large understand that an Indian chief of some note at the head of the peaceable and government-fed Indians at Camp Grant did on or about June 1, 1871, unprovokedly kill Charles McKinney on his farm near Camp Grant. The paper also chided Collier for receiving the same murdering chief, for clothing and feeding him at public expense, and for showing him high regard by putting a showy sash on him. Editor Wesson concluded, "Need any man be in doubt as to what impression was made upon that savage murderer's mind?" The day before that editorial blast, Deputy Marshall departed for Camp Grant to arrest Eskimensen. But he had been tipped, almost certainly by Whitman. That lawman was coming and gone by the time they arrived. Adding to the outrage, the Citizen noted, after the marshal left, Eskimensen returned to the post and continued drawing regular rations. A warrant for Eskimensen's arrest never was served, even though his guilt was all but certain. In fact, admitted to by Eskimensen, according to Jeannie Marion, author of an unpublished biography of the Aravaipas leader. In his meetings with Collier at Camp Grant, Eskimensen said, "I was angry and killed the first white citizen. After that, I wish to confess I went on a raid against the Papago to recover my children." Author Marion said both of these remarks are in Collier's originally handwritten report to the Secretary of the Interior, dated September 18th. They were deleted from his final published report. "It is not clear who deleted them," Marion said in an interview. "I assume it was Collier, but it's possible that someone in Washington did it. There was so much upset over the massacre, and officials in Washington really wanted to maintain peace as long as possible. If this came out, it wouldn't have presented Apaches in a good light." Much later, Eskimensen also admitted his guilt to Army Scout Sam Bowman. In a quote that has echoed through the decades, he explained, "I did it to teach my people that there must be no friendship between them and the white man. Anyone can kill an enemy, but it takes a strong man to kill a friend." Even with these confessions, the chief was never tried for the crime. He was saved, Marion maintained, by Collier's sympathy and official Washington's desire to keep a lid on an inflammatory situation. Oddly, though, Whitman, the peacemaker, was arrested and court-martialed for, as Wesson gleefully reported, being deeply drunk, insulting women in public, and behaving in such a manner that no gentleman could associate with him without feeling deeply humiliated. The trumped-up charges were eventually dismissed, but the action showed the attitude of the military and the citizenry toward anyone favoring peace. Eskimensen's murder of McKinney haunted the chief the remainder of his days, during which he was repeatedly harassed and accused of wherever crime could be conveniently laid at his door. When John P. Clum arrived in Arizona in June of 1874 to begin his tenure as Indian agent at San Carlos, he found Eskimensen at the new Camp Grant wearing shackles as he made adobe bricks. For a number of reasons, including leading his band and six others in an escape from the guardhouse there in January of 1874, he had fallen into disfavor with the post commander, who considered him a bad Indian. After his release later that summer, the chief joined Clum at San Carlos and for 3 years proved invaluable in helping manage the Apaches there. The two became close friends. Eskimensen departed San Carlos in 1877 and tried farming and ranching at the San Pedro River. The chief led a prosperous colony of 6 or 8 families. He even had lines of credit totaling several $1,000s with Tucson merchants, probably some of the same ones who had organized the massacre of his family. But trouble was never far off. In 1887, while living peacefully as a rancher on the San Pedro River, Escomenzam found himself in a dispute with Pinal County Sheriff over cattle supposedly rustled by one of his band. The chief refused to surrender any of his men, no doubt believing they would be murdered, yet he still made honest efforts to resolve the matter. Nevertheless, the confrontation escalated until Escomenzam had no choice but to move with his men to San Carlos to avoid arrest. Assuming his women and children were safe, he left them behind. In his absence, a mob of 35, part of the sheriff's posse, trashed his ranch and took it over. "They came the next day after I left my ranch," Escomenzam told Klum, "and they shot at my women, putting bullets through skirts, and drove them off." In 1891, while living in San Carlos, the chief was arrested and accused, with scant evidence, of abetting Apache Kid, a murderer and relative of the chief's, who had fled the reservation 4 years earlier. Klum, Escomenzan's passionate defender, wrote that without trial and without benefit of a single witness to his supposed wrongdoing, the chief was sent as a military precaution to Mount Vernon, Alabama, home to other imprisoned Apaches. When Klum, the founder of the Tombstone Epitaph, reunited with Escomenzan in 1894, he asked the chief why he was at Mount Vernon. After stuttering furiously, Escomenzan's habit when excited, he said, "Great lies, you know." The remark was a fitting summation of his dealings with the White Eyes. Escomenzan and his Arapahoes were finally released from Mount Vernon in 1894 and sent back to San Carlos, the only Apache band allowed to return to Arizona. They did so quietly and amid tight security, fearing an assassination attempt. Death took Escomenzan before the territory's citizens could. In December 1895, Chief died of chronic stomach trouble at about age of 67, without ever standing before a bar of justice for murdering Charles McKinney. Whether he should have is a debate without resolution. Klum, at the very least, believed his action had to be judged in context. In a letter to the Indian Rights Association pleading for Escomenzan's release from Mount Vernon, he wrote, "It is not strange that we can pass lightly over the 128 treacherous and cowardly murders instigated by white men, Camp Grant, while we carefully treasure the memory of a single killing by an Indian, and, after a lapse of 23 years, point to him and say, 'This man murdered his friend,' without even giving him the benefit of the circumstances which instigated the crime." Vincent Collier, based on a letter to his superiors in Washington, plainly believed the answer was no. He said the massacre of Escomenzan's family and people opened a condition of war between the whites and Apaches, and Escomenzan's killing of McKinney was an incident in that war. Also, Collier wrote that losing so many members of his family in Camp Grant seems to have practically crazed him. Certainly, the vigilantes responsible for the massacre were not held to an answer, except for a 5-day show trial that ended in acquittal after 19 minutes of deliberation. And it is highly likely that the Arapahoes had not committed the raids for which they were being blamed. Arthur Marion said most historians believe the culprit was probably the band led by Chiricahua Chief Jew. He was raiding out of Mexico at that time, but the military in Tucson wasn't aware of it and attributed it to the Arapahoes, said Marion, but it is impossible to say with certainty who it was. Historian Dan Thrapp contended that Escomenzan's people were merely convenient targets, the easiest collection of Apaches to kill. So Escomenzan maintained he killed a friend to teach his people about the treachery of whites. It was the best way he knew to protect his people. As impenetrable as the logic might be today, it said much about the power of rage and revenge in a time of war between two opposite cultures. That brings us to the end of our story, Eskimensen's Revenge. Next, from the popular magazine True West. Readers of True West magazine can write in and ask questions of Arizona's official state historian, Marshall Trimble. Here are some questions and his informative responses. From the January 2020 issue of True West magazine, reader Chase Appleby of Venice, Florida writes the Marshal, "What was the relationship between U.S. Marshals and town marshals or county sheriffs?" Marshal Trimble answers, "A deputy U.S. Marshal was responsible for federal crimes, and a town marshal or county sheriff had authority dealing with town or county crimes respectively. Many times, county sheriffs or town marshals were also deputized as deputy U.S. Marshal. Virgil Earp is a good example. He was a marshal of Tombstone and deputy U.S. Marshal. But being a U.S. Marshal was a full-time administrative job. A person in that position rarely makes arrests. So Gunsmoke's Matt Dillon being a U.S. Marshal in Dodge City was bogus. The town marshal, county sheriff, and their deputies would have been responsible for the day-to-day job of upholding the law." Next question is submitted to Marshal Trimble by reader Rick Clark of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He asks, "Did the Indians really whoop and holler during battles?" Attacking warriors from most tribes did use yells and screams to terrify and discombobulate their foes. Apaches were experts at terrifying their prey, running behind rocks and cover to unleash screams and arrows. It wasn't just American Indians who used that strategy. It's just about all cultures used battle cries. It's pretty universal then and now. A good example is the rebel yell used by Confederates during the Civil War. The next question is posted by Lewis McMullen of Henderson, Tennessee. The reader writes Marshal Trimble the following question. In The Searchers, John Wayne is seen wearing a straw hat. Is that authentic? Marshal Trimble says, "Straw hats were quite common in the Southwest. Soldiers, Indians, settlers, farmers, and cowboys all wore them. Soldiers could buy them at the settler store for around 50 cents. Felt hats were more popular in the cooler months, but when the weather heated up, they switched to straws. The big drawback, straw hats didn't hold up in the rain or snow." Reader Paul Gortez of Phoenix, Arizona, writes Marshal Trimble and asks, "Who was Lew Cooley?" Marshal Trimble says, "Cooley played a major role in the wider Vendetta ride. He worked as a stage driver in Tombstone and had friends in Wells Fargo management. He also acted as a special agent in April 1882 when Wyatt Earp was staying at the Henry Clay Hooker's Sierra Bonita Ranch. Cooley brought him $1,000 of expense money provided by Wells Fargo General Superintendent John Valentine. Cochise County Sheriff John Behan learned of the plan and arrested Cooley, charging him with aiding Wyatt. Judge Wells Spicer dismissed the case, calling the charges frivolous." The next question to Marshal Trimble is from Bob Powers of Cincinnati, Ohio. Bob writes in, "An article in the July 2019 issue of True West says, the photographer of the authenticated Billy the Kid tintype is unknown, yet it also claims that he left his thumbprints on the ferrotype while developing. Could he not be traced by those?" The U.S. courts first began accepting fingerprints in 1911, although some identification was done in the 1890s. The tintypist could not be traced unless there was a record of his prints, which is unlikely.
I ran this by Dan Buck, an expert on the subject of fingerprints, and he replied, well, yes, if the tintypist was arrested and printed by the FBI in 1930, then maybe.
I hope you found our stories interesting. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds reader, and we'll have more stories for you the next time we meet. If you missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.